Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Lowy Institute. I'm Michael Fullilove, the Executive Director, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to today's event. Today we're joined by Kenneth Roth, the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch. We've hosted Ken at the Institute on other occasions, but we're delighted to welcome him back to our new digs here at 1 Bligh Street. Today, Ken will discuss some of the key global developments in 2015 and 16, particularly the Syrian conflict and the refugee and migration crisis, and how they relate to what he calls the politics of fear. Ken Roth is the Executive Director of Human Rights Watch, which is one of the world's leading human rights organisations. Each year, HRW publishes more than 100 reports and briefings on human rights conditions in some 90 countries. Prior to joining Human Rights Watch in 1987, Ken served as a federal prosecutor in New York and for the Iran-Contra investigation in Washington, D.C. He's a graduate of Yale and Brown. He's conducted numerous human rights investigations and missions around the world, and he speaks regularly at well-known forums, including the Council on Foreign Relations, the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, the Munich Security Conference, and the World Economic Forum. Ladies and gentlemen, Kenneth Roth. I will talk to Ken and put some questions to him for about 25 minutes or half an hour, and then there'll be time for questions. So please have your questions ready to address to Ken. Ken, let's start off with the Middle East. It seems that from North Africa to the Arabian Peninsula, there's chaos and civil war. There are a number of civil wars and proxy wars, hundreds of thousands dead in recent years, millions displaced. There's almost an Old Testament quality to this moment with its war and plague and flood, fire and exodus. So perhaps we can just start by talking to us a little bit about the human rights situation in Syria in particular and the wider region, and perhaps put it in some historical context for us.
All right, well, Michael, let me just begin by saying it's a pleasure to be back at Lowy, and thank you for having me again. It's good to see you all. I think what it's worth stating about Syria, which may be obvious, but it's just important not to forget, is that this is not your typical war. In your typical war, you have combatants shooting at combatants. And what makes this war so ugly, the reason it has generated so many millions of refugees, is that the Assad government has chosen to fight this war by targeting civilians who happen to live in opposition-held areas. The aim is to depopulate those areas, to make it harder for the rebels to operate there, and to also signal to other Syrians, this is what's going to happen to your village if you let the rebels in. It's going to get barrel bombed. And so the beginning of any solution is to stop these attacks on civilians. That would diminish the refugee flow. That would begin to create a political environment in which difficult compromises can be made. And the key to doing that, in my view, is Russia. Russia and Iran are the two principal supporters, but Russia is really the key supporter. We've seen that Iran operating by itself can't even sort of maintain a permanent defense. They were gradually losing ground. Russia came in as the game changer, but that also means that Russia has enormous leverage. And we've seen Putin use that leverage a couple of times with the sarin attacks by getting Assad to agree very quickly to the chemical deal. We've seen it in the diminution of the use of barrel bombs once Russia started bombing. But frankly, the West, John Kerry in particular, has been very reluctant to publicly pressure the Russians to really squeeze Assad to stop this targeting of civilians. And in my view, you're not going to get the opposition agreeing to the sort of transitional role that frankly is going to be needed. Nobody wants the Syrian government to collapse. So you're going to need Assad, running things for 12 months, 18 months, or whatever. The opposition won't even agree to that while Assad continues to target, their friends, family members, and neighbors. So I think that is not just a matter of atmospherics, it's a matter of political necessity to allow us to emerge from this horrible war.
What about Islamic State? What about the human rights abuses taking place within the territories controlled by IS?
Well, those are awful, but I think that the game plan that most people envision is that there would be some sort of peace between the regime and the more moderate opposition, and then together they could take on ISIS. I don't think anybody thinks that it would be that complicated to take on ISIS if there's a real kind of concentrated focus on them, including the Kurds coming down from the north. But right now everybody's focusing somewhere else. ISIS is nobody's priority. And in that context, it's I wouldn't say it's thriving. It is retrenching a bit at this stage, but it hasn't faced a concerted opposition. And that's why to use a peace plan is not the right word exactly. You know, it's a partial peace plan. But if you could get partial peace between the regime and the opposition, they would then take on ISIS. That's not going to happen until you stop this targeting of civilians.
To press the point on Islamic State, though, obviously they've committed a lot of barbarous acts against people living within their territory, and they have some appeal to other people living, indeed, on the other side of the world, living in Melbourne, in fact, as we found out overnight, but living around the world. So how much of a human rights issue is the rise of Islamic State for you?
Oh, it's a huge issue. It's responsible for horrendous atrocities, you know, the beheadings, you know, burning a soldier in a cage. I mean, this is an awful group. Mm. And so, you know, containing it in Iraq and Syria is a very big priority, and obviously ensuring that it doesn't spread elsewhere is a priority as well, you know, including right now in Libya, where it's established a real beachhead. So, I think, you know, part of the solution to that is the way the wars are fought in Iraq and Syria. In Syria, you know, ISIS thrives on Assad's atrocities. It's the not Assad. In Iraq, if you look at ISIS's predecessor, al-Qaeda in Iraq, it was defeated through, you know, the so-called Sunni awakening, where the U.S. was able to convince Sunni tribes to join with the Iraqi government. And al-Qaeda was then very quickly defeated. What happened in subsequent years with Prime Minister Maliki, who led a very sectarian kind of regime, and who, you know, partly through his own paranoia, didn't trust the multi-sectarian Iraqi army and deliberately weakened that with the rise of Shia militia. Given, you know, Shia militia at the forefront of military efforts in Iraq, suddenly if you're a Sunni male in Western Iraq, you began to feel safer, safer under ISIS than facing the Shia militia, who were disappearing and killing young Sunni men. And so, you know, the real challenge in Iraq is how do you rebuild the confidence of the Sunni community? And, you know, I have to say the West's military response in Iraq has been smart in this respect, in that they've been very careful to bomb to advance the Iraqi army, but not to advance the Shia militia. They've tried to keep a certain distance from the Shia militia. But, you know, the real question is the Iraqi army sufficiently rebuilt now, at least in combination with Kurdish forces, with the Peshmerga, so that it's not dependent on the Shia militia? Because as you recall, when ISIS was advancing, it was the Shia militia that stopped the taking of Baghdad. It wasn't the Iraqi army, which pretty much crumbled. And so the key is sort of a non-sectarian response in Iraq, which I think, you know, ultimately then it could play its part in defeating ISIS.
Ken, obviously the atrocities and the sort of unspeakable condition of human rights in a number of these countries, especially Syria, is driving the huge exodus of people towards Europe, this unprecedented people movement. There are more refugees, asylum seekers, and internally displaced people now than at any time since the Second World War. They're coming from Syria, from Afghanistan and Iraq, but also from Eritrea, from Nigeria, from Iran, and other countries. And we're seeing the deaths of thousands of people trying to cross the Mediterranean Sea. I think it was about 4,000 people last year. Now, Human Rights Watch has been very critical, I think, of European governments in terms of their response. So how should Europe respond to this really unprecedented people movement?
Well, first, I think it's important to characterize, you know, what this refugee crisis really is about. I mean, a million people crossed the Mediterranean in 2015. In percentage terms, that represents 0.2% of the European Union's population. So, you know, not an impossible number by any means. I mean, even if they all went to Germany, which they didn't, it would be 1.2% of Germany's population. So in my view, the key here is not so much the numbers as it is the sense that Europe has lost control of its borders. There's chaos on the borders, and there's fear that behind these, you know, largely legitimate refugees, as you mentioned, they're mostly from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, that there's an almost infinite number of economic migrants who could follow. And so the question is, you know, how do you regain control of Europe's borders while respecting the rights of people to seek asylum? And I think that there are sort of three key elements to what a rights-respecting policy would be. One is you really, you know, do what you can to stop the atrocities that are driving the refugee flow, so places like Syria. You know, second, you invest big time, as Europe now is doing, in the countries of first refuge to make it possible for people to stay closer to home, which, you know, most people want to do. If you're a Syrian, you envision the war being over at some stage, you'd like to go home. In the meantime, you want to live in a country where it's possible to build a life. So investing in schools, medical care, jobs, housing. And the $6 billion that the European Union has promised Turkey is a step in the right direction. The third element for me is setting up a big-time resettlement program. And resettlement, as opposed to asylum, is what you do, you know, before you have to cross the sea. It would be, you know, screening people in Turkey, Jordan, Lebanon, screening out the security risks, screening out the economic migrants. But those who are have genuine refugee status, giving them some reasonable prospect of getting to a haven in the West. And I think if, you know, if Europe were to propose, say, 250,000 refugee intake a year, which is what the Dutch leaders proposed, if the rest of the world could match that, you know, 500,000 a year is a lot of people. And I think your average, say, Syrian would not risk his or her family's life on a boat because there'd be light at the end of the tunnel. On the other hand, just sort of shutting the door, saying, you know, no, we're going to take just a mere pittance out of Turkey, isn't going to convince people to stop. Now, what Europe has done, and this is, you know, different from Australia, we can get to Australia in a moment, but the Europe has basically said, we are going to give you an individual asylum hearing if you arrive in Greece, but we're going to apply this rule of a so-called safe third country. That is to say, even though you have a legitimate asylum claim, we're going to say that you should have made that claim in Turkey because we're going to pretend Turkey is a safe third country. And, you know, there's an element of truth to that in that there are 2.5 million Syrian refugees who are living in Turkey today. But in many important respects, Turkey is not safe in that Turkey has not ratified the Refugee Convention insofar as it applies to anybody other than Europeans. So Syrians, Iraqis, Afghans have no legal rights, which is why Syria today is holding 100,000 Syrians on the Syrian side of the border as they're desperately sort of escaping ISIS and Assad and the like. You know, today there are 500,000 kids out of school in Syria. I mean, you can't say that this is a place, in Turkey, that this is a place where it is possible to build a real family life, a future for your family. And most important, you know, everybody's being sent back to Turkey, but well as the Syrians are being treated, the Iraqis and Afghans are given no even deferential status. They're just being sent back. And so for a very significant number of people being put back to Turkey, Turkey is not safe. And it's that fiction that I think is the real harm in Europe's approach so far. So what we would rather see is, you know, instead of relying on this fiction, we'd rather see much greater resettlement directly from Turkey so that people voluntarily choose that resettlement route rather than get on the boats. The coercive approach of sending people back to this, you know, fake safe country is not consistent with refugee law.
But if Europe maintains a policy where you get to claim asylum or you get to try to claim asylum if you reach Greece's shores, why wouldn't you have continued huge numbers of people trying to make it to Europe? I mean, you began by saying that a million refugees have crossed the Mediterranean and supposedly there's a huge number behind them, but an almost infinite number, I think you said. But in a sense, isn't that true? I mean, aren't there literally millions of people in many countries around the world who would be prepared to take significant risks in order to take their country, to take their family into Europe? Why wouldn't you want to do that?
Well, because no economic migrant is entitled to enter Europe. The people who are entitled are formal asylum seekers. That is, people who can demonstrate a well-founded fear of persecution back at home. And so if you did, you know, if you had a serious screening process in Turkey combined with resettlement, that would have some big advantages. It would allow screening in a much more orderly way than the current chaos in Greece. It would also allow Europe to make appeals to the rest of the world. I mean, once somebody's in Europe, it's basically Europe's issue. Mm. But, you know, while they're still in Turkey or elsewhere, they can make an appeal. You know, you want to preserve the European Union, do your part. You know, Australia, Canada, United States, Brazil, Gulf States, Russia, whoever. And if you then reduce the flow even significantly, I don't think anybody pretends it would be completely reduced, but if you reduce it significantly, then the more orderly remainder in Greece can be screened. And if they're just a bunch of economic migrants, they'll be screened out and sent back, and that's perfectly legal. So I just think that there is a big advantage to having a larger refugee resettlement program rather than the current chaotic asylum screening in Greece.
Is there an argument for trying to renovate the whole international refugee protection regime? I mean, can we say, given those numbers, the number of refugees and asylum seekers around the world, that the system that was established after the Second World War is no longer fit for purpose?
You know, it's easy to say that because, you know, the it was mainly Europeans who benefited from the post-World War II refugee regime. I mean, I'm a beneficiary. You know, my father was a refugee from Nazi Germany. You know, I wouldn't be alive today probably if he had not been accepted as a refugee in the United States. There are many, many people like this. I suspect a lot of Australia is like that. I think there's something unseemly just because those who need refugee protection today happen to be Muslim or happen to be from non-European parts of the world to suddenly say, you know, we're not going to let you in. We're going to rewrite the regime. I think there's, you know, when people are in desperate need, and there's no question that they are in places like Syria, Iraq, we have a duty to do what we can to
help. But isn't it the case that the refugee rate, the international refugee regime, is not working for refugees either?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't go that far. It's true that many people, far fewer are being resettled than should be. But the nonetheless, there are, you know, millions of refugees who have found refuge, usually in countries of first refuge. So, you know, who are the biggest refugee, you know, receivers today? Well, you know, it's Lebanon, where a quarter of the population is refugee. It's Turkey, it's Jordan, it's Kenya for Somalis. You know, it still is Pakistan and Iran for Afghans. So, you know, the Western countries do all the belly aching, but it's the non-Western countries that do the actual receiving.
Let me ask you, you mentioned Australia, and we can talk a bit about Australia's policies on this issue. More generally, as you know, Australia launched a bid for a seat on the Human Rights Council late last year, and I think I'm right that in your 2016 World Report, you described Australia's refugee policies as abusive and suggested that Australia's shortcomings could undermine our ability to call for stronger rights protections abroad. I mean, there are, of course, a lot of countries on the UN Human Rights Council, countries such as China and Russia, whose human rights records are far from perfect and significantly worse than ours, I would say. Do you think that it's really true that internationally, in that kind of diplomatic election, people look at Australia and say, well, it's not really entitled to be, or it may not be entitled to be on the Human Rights Council because of its refugee policies? Or do you think most countries would look at Australia and say, well, it's a liberal democracy where powerful people are held accountable to the courts, and overall, it's the kind of country that should be on the Human Rights Council? Yeah.
Well, I mean, Michael, you're right that, you know, sadly, the council has a number of very abusive governments on it. But Australia shouldn't take too much heart in that fact, because a lot of the regions of the world game the system. And they propose what's known as a clean slate, meaning they only propose the number of candidates as there are openings. And so Saudi Arabia gets on because it has no competition. Australia operates in the so-called WEOG, the Western Europe and Other Group. And so it does have competition. I think it's fighting against, or will fight against, Spain and France for two seats or something like that. So it is not going to be able to slip in without competition. And it's not competing against Russia or China. It's competing against Western democracy. So its record will matter. Now, you know, has Australia's refugee policy or asylum policy affected its ability to promote human rights? Yes, in the sense that, you know, regionally, the top priority has been stopping the boats. And so, you know, you got Tony Abbott a couple weeks ago who said, you know, well, of course we closed our eyes to 30,000 people being killed in the final years of the Sri Lankan war against the Tamil Tigers. We needed Sri Lanka's assistance to stop the boats. Or, you know, when you hand over $55 million to Cambodia, despite Hun Sen's, you know, complete clampdown on any opposition, to accept five asylum seekers from Manus, you know, three of whom are no longer there. It's hard to push these governments on human rights issues when, you know, if that's the top priority, stopping the boats. I have to say, I mean, if I could step back for a moment, we were talking about Europe. You know, I'm not Australian, I'm just visiting here, but I am struck how there is this discrepancy between the reality facing Australia and the level of sort of vitriol about the boats. Because, you know, I mean, if you compare the height of the boat crisis, which was, I think, about 30,000 people coming in a few years ago. So that is, what, it's I guess, 0.15% of Australia's population. Compare that to basically the 1.2% of Germany's population that it just dealt with, you know, or, you know, let alone the 25% of Lebanon or whatever. I mean, it was a tiny percentage. It also, you know, it's 10% of the regular migration admissions in Australia. So this was, it was a drop in the bucket. And, you know, I don't know domestic politics well enough to know why it was politically expedient to exploit this issue. But the articulated threat doesn't correspond with reality. But instead, what Australia has done is, you know, using this subterfuge of Manus and Nauru, it is basically, you know, sending people to, you know, utterly intolerable situations. You know, situations where they're not safe if they get out of detention, so they're stuck kind of permanently in detention with no hope. You know, I spoke yesterday to a couple of Syrian asylum seekers, and, you know, so, you know, ostensibly to prevent loss of life at sea, these guys have got this choice. You know, do they spend the rest of their lives in detention, basically, because they're afraid to leave detention if that means, you know, just being let out in the very hostile population in PNG, or do they go back to Assad's prisons, which are notorious for torture and execution, or in one case, does he go back to ISIS, which would pick him up in 2 seconds because he's coming back from the West? You know, so, I mean, this idea of saving lives, you got to weigh it against what? You know, these are people who are fleeing for their lives, and to close that door is certainly risking many lives. And to say that this is humanitarian is looking at, you know, one very tiny part of the problem. So I just, you know, I don't see the rationale for this panic here.
You're right that that a desire to save lives was not the only motivator there, but it's surely one important moral factor that has to be weighed up. I mean, many people in this room, I think, were uncomfortable with the asylum policies of the Howard government at some visceral level. But we also watched what happened when the subsequent Labor government unpicked those policies. And at the end of it, I think from memory, it was about 1,000 people died at sea coming to Australia. It was harder, I think, at the end of that process, even for people who were very sympathetic to those policies, to say that is a better outcome than what prevailed beforehand. So, I mean, is it really as black and white as you present, I guess, is what I'm asking.
If you're really concerned about saving lives, you'd have a much larger resettlement program. You know, if you just double resettlement, you know, that would kind of take care of these numbers. It would still be substantially less than people let in on other migration grounds. And that would, you know, undermine the incentive to get on the boats. You can patrol much more aggressively. I mean, Italy faced this. You know, when at first people were drowning in the Mediterranean, and Italy with its Mare Nostrum showed that if you patrol aggressively, you can save lives. And so I just don't buy it that this is about saving lives. You know, people were drowning because they were not being actively rescued, and there are alternatives. Plus, you know, if you do shut off asylum, I mean, yes, some people can get to Europe, but some people for various reasons are coming this direction. And to say, no, you can't seek asylum is condemning them to continued life, you know, for the Hazara in Afghanistan or the Sunni in Iraq or the, you know, whomever in Syria. You know, there are lots of lives lost there because they have no place to go. So I just think it's much more complicated than this sort of simplistic view that, oh, a few boats went down, therefore let's, you know, do anything we can to stop the boats.
Let me ask you some other questions about Australia, a couple of questions about Asia, and then I'm going to open up to the audience. It was about a year ago that two Australian citizens were executed by the Indonesians. At the time, I know Human Rights Watch, and I made a similar argument that Australia might like to take on, that one way for Australia to deal with this was to become a leader in the advocacy against the death penalty in the region, that in fact this had some national interest values as well as conforming with our values, because if we are advocating on behalf of people on, if we're trying to close death row completely rather than just getting our people off it, it bulletproofs us against the argument that we're only concerned with Australians. So can I ask you to talk a bit about that? What do you think Australia could achieve if it were to take aim at the death penalty? And is there any reason to be hopeful on the question of the death penalty, given that Asia in some ways is world's best practice at executing people?
Yeah. Well, I mean, our point that we were making a year ago is that, you know, Australia would be much more effective if its death penalty advocacy was generalized rather than being heightened only when an Australian was at risk. And as you say, there are plenty of practitioners of the death penalty in Asia, and a sort of more principled, more systematic approach to the problem would, I think, be more effective. Where I think Indonesia is particularly vulnerable in its use of the death penalty is that, you know, even though the death penalty is not prohibited by international human rights law, there is, you know, one, a strong trend against it, but two, and this is what's relevant here, where it is still used, it is meant to be used only for the most serious offenses, which has been understood to mean murder. And Indonesia is using it for drug offenses. And so that, you know, I think quite clearly violates existing human rights law. There is real momentum right now to pull back the drug war. There was just a big summit in New York at the UN General Assembly. There are major non-Western governments pushing to end the drug war, you know, Mexico, Colombia. I think that there is mileage to be had by, you know, even if you don't take on the death penalty per se, at least pushing the idea that mere drug offenses, you know, even if you see them as terrible, don't rise to the level of murder and therefore should not be subject of execution.
Tell me, on the subject of Indonesia, you've just returned from a trip to Jakarta where you helped to launch a symposium into the anti-communist purges in the 1960s, and I think this received approval from the Indonesian government in this case. Can you tell us a bit about this symposium and the issue?
Yeah, I didn't launch it. I just happened to be there as it was about to be launched. It's very much an Indonesian initiative. But, you know, I think most of you know, in 1965-66, there was a coup attempt against the Sukarno government, and followed by the murder in the course of roughly 6 months of at least 500,000 people. You know, most of them ostensibly communists, but when you're murdering that many, you know, who knows who gets picked up? A lot of them ethnic Chinese. And Suharto shortly thereafter took over and just swept this horrible incident under the rug. And it has been, you know, impossible to in any official way examine this ever since. Now, Jokowi, who I've got to say I've been very impressed with in many respects, I mean, leaving aside his resort to the death penalty, has authorized the beginning of a process to look at this. And so last week there was a two-day symposium, which was really just a discussion about what you can do. It was, you couldn't even say it was a truth-telling process, because one of the interesting things is I spoke with the person who was orchestrating this, the leader of it, and starting a truth-telling process was deemed too sensitive because two of the institutions that were deeply implicated in 1965-66, both the army and the Islamic group, NU, are adamantly opposed to any opening up of this story. And so the most they could do, the courageous thing to do, was to have this symposium. Now, they were hoping, if not with this symposium, then soon thereafter, to have some kind of an apology and some kind of reconciliation process. And the point we made to them is you can't reconcile when you don't know what you're reconciling about. You know, you can't apologize when there's no factual record. And, you know, I think it's useful to put that kind of pressure, which is really pro-Jokowi pressure, to help him overcome the army's resistance. We've been pushing Obama to release the U.S. files on the working level relationship, because there's suspicion that the U.S. was turning over names and people were then getting killed. It'd be very interesting for Australia to also open its records from that period. And I think, again, this, you know, this truth-telling from abroad would facilitate efforts within Indonesia to launch a truth-telling process there.
Let me ask you about another Southeast Asian country, Myanmar. I've noticed on your Twitter, on your very active Twitter feed, that you've been quite critical of Aung San Suu Kyi in recent years, especially in relation to the Rohingya. Suu Kyi is in a complicated position. She's a human rights paragon and a Nobel Peace Prize laureate, but she's also a politician, as she was very explicit about when she came and spoke at the Lowy Institute.
That was a low point, yes.
Speaking at the Institute,
no, or... No, that line, I'm not a human rights activist, I'm okay. A politician.
But, well, she is a politician, and yes. she wants power, and she has power now. But as an elected politician, she obviously has to balance lots of different issues, public opinion, dealing with the other elements who wield power in the Myanmar system. Is it time for us to cut Aung San Suu Kyi a bit of slack, do you think?
Well, I mean, at this point, I still am deeply disappointed with her policy toward the Rohingya. And this was just, you know, an ugly political compromise. The Rohingya are so unpopular in Burma that she just wasn't going to risk the political cost of backing their right to citizenship, their right not to be confined in concentration camps, their right not to be violently attacked, because that was going to lose her Burmese nationalist votes. It was a political calculation. I don't agree that that was the right thing to do. But even leaving that aside, I actually think that it helps her today to keep the pressure on Burma, because, you know, she is nominally in charge as, you know, senior leader, if she can't be president. But the military is still running the security agencies. You know, the military is in charge of the army, it's in charge of the police, it's in charge of the intelligence. It is, you know, she's very constrained by the military. So in Geneva, just recently at the UN Human Rights Council, Australia took the lead in trying to downgrade the scrutiny of Burma. It was sort of on heightened scrutiny, and Australia pushed toward the kind of scrutiny that you have for kind of friendlier governments. And that was defeated, but I think that effort was a mistake, because I think that it, given who's really still in charge, they need that kind of tough scrutiny.
But your criticism is not really of the other elements in Myanmar. I mean, you're quite critical of Suu Kyi herself, aren't you? You're not putting pressure on the other elements in order to help her.
Both. In other words, I mean, we were critical of Aung San Suu Kyi for her stance on the Rohingya. We were very critical and remain critical of the army for, you know, continuing to constrain Burmese democracy. And frankly, we've been very critical of the, you know, the Buddhist nationalists, the 969 movement, for kind of whipping up anti-Muslim hysteria. So they're, you know, we're pretty multifaceted in our criticism.
You're equal opportunity critic.
Yes.
Let me ask you about China, another country that is a big preoccupation for Australia. When I was at university in the 1990s, the debate then on China was, how do we balance human rights concerns on the one hand with business interests on the other? And it was very similar in Washington, the most favoured nation status debates in the Congress and so on. But these days, the debate really is about balancing, is really about how can we nudge and pressure and influence the Chinese into being more restrained in their external behaviour, in the way that they behave towards their neighbours, in the seas around their continent, the way that they project power. How do we balance that with our business interests? And it seems to me that, that is sort of the tenor of the debate in the United States and in much of the Western countries too. So is it true that some of the human rights issues have sort of been squeezed out? Because now, in a way, a lot of Western countries are so concerned about China's external behaviour that they have less bandwidth to criticise it for its internal behaviour.
Well, first, Mike, let me just make it going back to your 1990s.
Yeah.
Because you may remember then everybody's saying, you know, trade with China, build a middle class, and there will be a natural evolution toward democracy, and that's how you'll improve human rights. It was win-win for everybody. You don't have to, you know, push too hard on human rights right then and there. And so we've had 20 years of economic growth, and we are facing the worst crackdown in civil society since Tiananmen. So the theory didn't work. Now, you're right about bandwidth, that, you know, trade remains a major preoccupation. We've added to it a more muscular China, particularly in the South China Sea. I think that it is, you know, I think it's a mistake to be downgrading human rights for two reasons. I mean, one is that, you know, while I don't, a number of these policies, for example, the militarism in the South China Sea is popular in China. But I think that that's popular within a very controlled information environment. And if you had more multiplicity of voices, you at least have a chance of having more of a constraint on the government. Certainly we've seen, you know, where they've allowed Sina Weibo to operate more freely a few years ago, it was constraining governmental misconduct. They've cracked down on social media, so that's less of a factor now. But, you know, when Turnbull shows up in Beijing and you know, mocks so-called megaphone diplomacy, you know, and you can, I mean, it's such a funny term, you know, megaphone diplomacy. You know, like, it sounds so rude to be, you know, speaking to a diplomat across the table through a megaphone. Of course you wouldn't do that. You know, but what that completely ignores is that the important recipient of the message is not the diplomat sitting over there. It's the Chinese people. And if all you're doing is having nice, quiet conversations in the back room of the foreign ministry, the Chinese people don't hear you. And so they see, you know, a big Australian delegation showing up in Beijing and only talking about trade and security and leaving the Chinese people in the lurch. I believe that, you know, change in a country as vast as China is going to come from the Chinese people. And the key role that Western countries can play is to embolden those people, to help create a bit of political space in which they can operate. And I think we have a responsibility to do that. But it's not just Australia. It's, you know, one Western delegation after another that, you know, pays lip service, quiet lip service to human rights, and then goes on with the important stuff. And that's not how we're going to reform China.
I've got more questions to ask you. I may come back and ask you about your own country's politics a little bit later if there's time. But in the meantime, let me go to the audience and give people an opportunity to ask you about what's on their mind. So can I ask you, I've seen this gentleman first, to when you get, wait for the microphone, perhaps indicate your name and an affiliation if you have one. And then if you could ask a question rather than making a speech, that would be much appreciated.
Rob Thomas. I'd be interested, actually, to what Michael said, following up, you know, we've obviously got the United States moving into election mode. I'd be interested to see now, it seems to be, you know, certainly Trump is becoming much more inward focused. Mm-hmm. How do you see the US involvement in human rights going forward, in particular, given it's caused a lot of the problems in Iraq and Syria?
Yeah, well, it's, I mean, let me just make one comment about Trump, and then I'll come back to your question. But it's, I think it's important to recognize that Trump reflects a phenomenon that we're seeing across much of the West today, which is kind of the rise of the far right. And that has become a real problem for the human rights movement because it is a threat to our values in a way that we haven't seen recently. You know, we're used to dealing with abusive governments here or there, and we criticize them. But the ability to shame governments depends on our ability to expose what they're doing and for the public to then express disapproval. But if a significant number of Westerners are rejecting human rights values, you know, because of fears of migration or fears of terrorism or just, you know, a sense that the economy is not working out for them, that, you know, undermines our ability to defend the human rights cause. And that's a problem. Now, you know, U.S. human rights policy has been in many ways disappointing. You know, and it's not just, you know, the fact, say, I mean, just to give one example, that you know, U.S. high-tech weapons are being used by the Saudis to kill large numbers of Yemeni civilians today. And the U.S. is sort of taking this hands-off approach, even though the U.S. is helping with targeting. You know, I don't want to say that the U.S. never does the right thing. I mean, I actually think in Cuba they did the right thing. Obama took a courageous step there. The U.S. tends to be better when there's not a lot at stake. So, you know, in Burma they were good, you know. They play, you know, helpful roles. Joseph Kabila just showed up, the Congolese president. He met with John Kerry yesterday. Kerry pushed him on the importance of stepping down at the end of his second term rather than create, you know, massive bloodshed in Congo the way we're seeing in Burundi next door. So, you know, there often are times where the U.S. does the right thing, but it has been far too reticent and far too willing to let other things take a priority. You know, I mean, we're a nonpartisan organization, so I'm not going to express my view about who should be the next president. But I will simply note that even Hillary has been very willing to forsake human rights when other things were at stake. She has not been somebody we can rely on when the going has gotten tough. And obviously, I don't have a lot of faith in Donald Trump or Ted Cruz or whoever. So it is, it's a difficult moment. We still, you know, work very closely with the U.S. government. I mean, they are sophisticated enough to recognize that Human Rights Watch has a lot to offer them. We have, you know, people on the ground around the world and often have much better access in the middle of war zones than, you know, an embassy official driving around in a bulletproof limousine. They recognize that we're principled, and so even when we criticize them, we're not doing it to score cheap points. But it is often a tough environment. You know, they regularly invite us. Before, you know, Obama went off to the Gulf just now, they invited us into the White House. We briefed them on everything. I think it affected things a little bit, but you know, marginally, and that's been difficult.
So it sounds like whether Hillary, Ted, or Donald are elected, there's going to be work for Human Rights Watch.
I'm not worried about that, yes. The question is just the amount of work. There may be some differences among those.
Hi, thank you. Anthony Zui, University of New South Wales. I was wondering if you could comment on current international development policy, the Sustainable Development Goals, which have been introduced at the beginning of this year and will guide development policy over the next 15 years or so. What is the place of human rights within that agenda, and how could it, or do you think it should or could be strengthened? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, there was a noticeable shift from the Millennium Development Goals to the Sustainable Development Goals with, frankly, much more willingness to recognize the role of human rights. I think that the challenge with the Sustainable Development Goals is that there's so many of them. And so even though it talks about the rule of law and it talks about inclusion and things of that sort, you know, it doesn't have the same focus of the Millennium ones. And we'll, you know, the good news is that allows for more sophistication and more precision. The bad news is, can we keep track of all these things and really push them all forward? So I think it was a step in the right direction. But we now have challenges to kind of hold the world to these articulations of goals.
Hi, Jonathan Pryke. I'm a research fellow in the Melanesia program here at the Lowy Institute. I'd like to bring us back to Papua New Guinea, where the mainstream Australian attention is overwhelmingly focused on the welfare of asylum seekers in Papua New Guinea. Mm-hmm. Many of the Papua New Guineans that I speak to argue that this attention marginalises the welfare needs of the nearly 8 million people in PNG, where significant human rights challenges occur every day. Mm-hmm. How do we reconcile the fact that this small population garners so much more attention than everyday Papua New Guineans?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure there's an answer to that. I mean, it's like, all politics is local. You know, people are much more concerned with what Australia is directly responsible for than what it's indirectly responsible for. I mean, obviously, Australia gives, $500 million of aid annually to PNG. There are enormous needs. There are enormous problems. I mean, we've done a lot of work on domestic violence and then the, complete lack of sensitivity to that problem on the part of many policing officials, and we've kind of put forward recommendations there. So I think the easiest answer to your solution is to shut down Manus, return to a lawful asylum policy, and then let PNG be a country in its own right. Not sure if that's what you were looking for, but that would certainly do the problem.
Aaron Conley, also from the Institute in the East Asia program here. I'm curious, going back to Myanmar or Burma, Human Rights Watch has been very critical of American and other governments' efforts to engage the Burmese military, the Tatmadaw, as well as the 969 movement, which you mentioned earlier. But it's very difficult to influence these groups to adopt more liberal positions if we're unable to speak to them. And one result of Human Rights Watch advocacy has been congressional restrictions on the U.S. government's ability to speak to the Burmese military in the 969 movement. And yet, reformist monks in Mandalay told me that they were also once Burmese chauvinists, Buddhist chauvinists, before they took trips to Indonesia and realized that Muslim societies could treat Burmese well and respectfully. And those programs are now programs that the U.S. government cannot sponsor. Similarly, the U.S. military is unable to have all but very limited contact with their Myanmar counterparts, who have also seemed very uninterested in meeting with American civilian leaders. They really want to meet their fellow military leaders. Do some of Human Rights Watch advocacy on Myanmar make it more difficult to advocate for change in Myanmar?
Okay. Yeah, we are not against engagement. Hillary says this, and it drives me crazy when she says that. The human rights movement didn't want us to engage, but we engaged, we moved Burma. That is a complete rewriting of history. In my view, the reason the Burmese military recognized the need to change is because of the sanctions. They saw their ASEAN partners booming economically, and Myanmar was, stagnating. So they ultimately, they had a choice. Do they want to become a province of China as the only country that could invest in them? Or do they want to open up, but opening up required, making political sacrifices? And I think it was that sanctioning that pushed the military to concede. Now, none of that precluded engagement. Of course you engage with people, you talk to people, but the question is not, do you engage or not, but do you engage with pressure or do you engage with capitulation? And we believe that engaging with pressure was the right thing to do, and I think history bore us out. What you're referring to with the military is that we do oppose training abusive forces in the absence of a real accountability process. Like in our view, if you have an army that is, committing atrocities, you don't bring them into the classroom and say, don't do that, and then expect them to go back in the field and behave. The way you get armies to behave is to prosecute them when they commit war crimes. In that context, with a real accountability process, then you can train. But if you just train without that, you end up becoming complicit in abuses. I mean, armies love that. They all want to get to travel to the United States and go to the training procedures and all. It's a perk. But they shouldn't get that, nor should the West become complicit in this, absent a genuine commitment domestically to hold abusive forces accountable. And that's our position.
Thanks very much. I'm Steph Cousins from Amnesty. And just wondering whether, with the Barack Obama refugee conference planned for September in New York, whether you have much optimism about that and about whether world leaders can get together to come up with some more ambitious plans for resettlement and what you think is achievable out of that.
What we hope is that this turns into a serious pledging conference similar to what the last conference he did on peacekeeping became. You know, the aim with peacekeeping was to get Western governments to make enough of a commitment so that the UN, you know, wasn't always begging often abusive forces to provide whatever troops they could. And then these are the forces that are running around, you know, committing sex crimes and the like. And, you know, we've seen so much of that recently. With the refugees, I mean, I actually think this is almost a national security issue at this stage. You know, do you believe in the European Union? You know, does the European Union as a collective, is that in the West's interest? Now, I happen to think it is. But if other governments think so too, then you got to put your money where your mouth is. And the way to save the European Union is to accept more refugees, not to put the entire burden on those 28 countries, and really on Germany, Sweden, Netherlands, and a handful of others. So Obama gets this. And now he has not been great. You know, let's put this in perspective, though. You know, he's been authorized to take in 10,000 Syrian refugees, and he's not even close. I think he's about 2,000 at this point, because he's been, you know, so fearful of right-wing challenges that he's taking in terrorists. You know, even though, you know, if you're a terrorist, you know, go as a student, go as a tourist. I mean, there's so many easier ways to get to the United States than as a refugee, you know. But he just, you know, he hasn't been willing to spend political capital on this. But I hope that this pledging conference turns into a real conference. If we get big enough numbers, that, you know, going back to how we started, that enables screeners in Turkey to offer refugees light at the end of the tunnel so they don't have to get on a boat. And that is good for everybody.
I'm going to ask the final question back on the politics of your own country. I know Rob dipped his toe in, but I'm going to dip my whole foot in.
Okay.
I know you're a nonpartisan organisation, so you can't tell us who you're going to vote for, but you're an American and you've got a strong interest in the process. Mm-hmm. So look into your crystal ball. What do you think is going to happen? How likely do you think Mr. Trump is to be the Republican nominee? And then is it a lay-down mazare if Trump wins that Hillary would beat him in the general, or do you think that would be a competitive race?
Yeah. I mean, I think the odds are that Trump emerges as the nominee. It won't be Cruz. You know, it's not as if they're going to dump Trump and goes to Cruz, since that's arguably getting worse. You know, there is some prospect of Paul Ryan being drafted, even though he said, you know, absolutely never, I'm not interested. You know, he said that before he became Speaker of the House as well. But, you know, if I had to bet right now, I would say that Trump pulls it out, that it would just be too divisive, even if he's a little bit short of an absolute majority going into the convention, to deny him of it at that stage would, I think, you know, lead to a real revolt among Republicans. So assuming that it's a Trump-Hillary battle in the general election, it is complicated to predict. And the reason is that, you know, American elections in recent years, well, they used to be about the swing vote. You know, everybody would push to the center and try to get that swing vote, and those swing votes would decide the elections. And the wisdom today is there are very few swing voters yet left. You know, that the U.S. is so ideologically divided that the number of swing voters who remain pale in comparison to the significance of turnout. And that what elections are about is turning out your base. So if it's Hillary versus Trump, that turnout question becomes complicated. Hillary, there is very little enthusiasm for Hillary. You know, Democrats will vote for her because it's better than not, you know, than the alternative. But she will never generate the enthusiasm that Obama did. So she's going to have a diminished turnout. And I think she's going to have a hard time converting the Sanders people. You know, so a lot of people are going to vote by staying home. On the Republican side, you're going to have Trump, you know, picking off some working class Democrats. You're going to have him losing Republicans who just can't stomach him, but they're not going to go to Hillary. They're going to just not vote. And then you're going to have real enthusiasm in his base. How does that all work out? I mean, I can't predict that, but it's going to be close. I don't think you can just look at the polls today and show, you know, Hillary up by a few points and say Hillary prevails. It's going to be close.
And that, whether it's good for the world, will be good for business for the Lowy Institute. So, ladies and gentlemen, we've had a terrific opportunity to talk to Ken today. He's given us a tour d'horizon. He's taken us from the Middle East to Asia and from Aung San Suu Kyi to Donald Trump, who are on opposite ends of the spectrum. I think we can agree to that. So please join me in thanking Kenneth Roth.